None of us were ever exposed to it. Like a disease of some kind. I remember they had a book by this guy named Philip Wiley, Generation of Vipers. He equated the church teachings with intellectual corruption, the stunting of young minds. Some people feel that way, I said. Yeah, I know. I don't get it, but it's something I run into out there in the world. It's like people think just because you go to church, you're not all that bright. I mean, just because I'm born again doesn't mean I lost IQ points. I'm sure you didn't. Thing is, I was raised without a moral compass. I couldn't get a sense of what the rules were, so I just kept pushing. I kept crossing the line, waiting for somebody to tell me where the boundaries were. But you were getting into trouble with the law, from what I heard. You must have known the rules, because every time you broke one, you ended up in court. Donovan says you spent more time in juvenile hall than you did at home. His smile was sheepish. That's true, but here's what's weird. I didn't mind juvie all that much. At least I could be with kids as screwed up as I was. Man, I was out of control. I ran wild. I was a maniac, freaked out about everything. It's hard to think about that now. I have trouble relating to myself and who I was back then. I know what happened. I mean, I know what I did, but I can't imagine doing it. I wanted to feel good. I've thought about this a lot, and that's the best explanation I've been able to come up with. I felt bad, and I wanted to feel better. Seemed to me dope was the quickest way to get there. I haven't touched drugs or hard liquor for more than 15 years. I might have a beer now and then, but I don't smoke, don't play cards, don't ballroom dance, don't take the Lord's name in vain, and don't cuss all that much. Stub my toe and I can turn the air blue, but most of the time I avoid swear words. Well, that's good. For me it is. Back then I was always teetering on the brink. I think I was hoping my parents would finally draw the line and mean it. That they'd say, here, this is it. You've finally gone and done it this time. But you know what? My dad was too soft. He waffled on everything. Even when he kicked my ass from here to next Tuesday, even when he threw me out of the house, he was saying, give this some thought, son. You can come back when you've figured it out. But like what? Figured what out? I didn't have a clue. I was rudderless. I was like a boat going full throttle but without any real direction, roaring around in big circles. Know what I mean? Sure I do. In high school, I was a screw-up myself. I ended up as a cop before I did this. He smiled. No kidding. You drank and smoked dope? Among other things, I said modestly. Come on. Like what? I don't know. Kids in my class were all clean-cut, but not me. I was a wild thing. I ditched school. I hung out with some low-life dudes, and I liked that. I liked them, I said. I was the odd one out, and so were they, I guess. Where'd you go to high school? Santa Teresa High. He laughed. You were a low-waller? Absolutely, I said. Low-wallers were the kids who quite literally perched on a low wall that ran along the back of the school property. Much smoking of cigarettes, funky clothes, and peroxided hair. Guy laughed. Well, that's great. I don't know how great it was, but it's what I did. How'd you get on track? Who says I am? He got to his feet as if he'd come to a decision. Come on out to the parsonage and meet Peter and Winnie, he said. They'll be in the kitchen at this hour, setting up supper for the Thursday night Bible study. I followed him up the center aisle and through a door at the rear. I could feel the first stirrings of resistance. I didn't want anyone pushing me to convert. Too much virtue is just as worrisome as wickedness in my book. Chapter 6. The parsonage was situated on the property adjacent to the church and consisted of a rambling white frame farmhouse, 2 stories tall, with green shutters and a shabby green shingled roof broken up with dormers. Across one end was a wide screened-in porch, distinctly tilted, as though an earthquake had pulled the concrete foundation loose. Behind the house, I could see a big red barn with a dilapidated one-car garage attached. Both the house and the barn were in need of a fresh coat of paint, and I noticed sunlight slanting through the barn roof where it was pierced with holes. Metal lawn chairs were arranged in a semicircle in the yard under a massive live oak tree. A weathered picnic table flanked with benches was set up close by, where I pictured Sunday school classes and church suppers during the summer months. I followed Guy across the yard. We went up the back steps and into the kitchen. The air was scented with sautéed onions and celery. Peter was a man in his 60s, balding, with a wreath of white hair that grew down into sideburns and wrapped around his jaw in a closely trimmed beard linked to a matching mustache. Pale sunlight coming through the window illuminated a feathery white fuzz across his pate. He wore a red turtleneck with a ribbed green sweater over it. He was just in the process of rolling out biscuit dough. The baking sheets to his right were lined with rows of perfect disks of dough ready for the oven. He looked up with pleasure as the two of us came in.
"Oh, Guy, good, it's you. I was just wondering if you were here yet. The furnace over at the church has been acting up again. First it clicks on, then it clicks off. On, then off."
"Probably the electronic ignition. I'll take a look."
Guy's posture was self-conscious. He rubbed his nose and then stuck his hands in his overall pockets as if to warm them.
"This is Kinsey Milhone. She's a private detective from Santa Teresa."
He turned and looked at me, tilting his head at the minister and his wife as he made the introductions.
"This is Peter Antle and his wife Winnie."
Peter's complexion was ruddy. His blue eyes smiled out at me from under ragged white brows.
"Nice to meet you. I'd offer to shake hands, but I don't think you'd like it. How are you at homemade biscuits? Can I put you to work?"
"Better not," I said. "My domestic skills leave something to be desired." He was on the verge of pursuing the point when his wife said, "Now, Pete," and gave him a look. Winnie Antle appeared to be in her late 40s, with short brown hair combed away from her face. She was brown-eyed, slightly heavy, with a wide smile and very white teeth. She wore a man's shirt over jeans, with a long knit vest that covered her wide hips and ample derriere. She was chopping vegetables for soup, a mountain of carrot coins piled up on the counter next to her. I could see two bunches of celery and assorted bell peppers awaiting her flashing knife. She was simultaneously tending a stock pot filled with vegetable cuttings boiling merrily. "Hello, Kinsey. Don't mind him. He's always trying to pass the work off onto the unsuspecting," she said, sending me a quick smile. "What brings you up this way?" Peter looked at Guy.
"You're not in trouble, I hope. You have to watch this man."
His smile was teasing, and it was clear he had no real expectation of trouble where Guy was concerned. Guy murmured the explanation, apparently embarrassed to be the recipient of such bad news.
"My father died. Probate attorney asked her to track me down."
Peter and Winnie both turned their full attention on Guy, whose earlier emotions were well under control. Peter said,
"Is that the truth? Well, I'm sorry to hear that."
He glanced over at me.
"We've often talked about his trying for a reconciliation. It's been years since he had any contact with his dad."
Guy shifted his weight, leaning against the counter with his arms crossed in front of him. He seemed to be directing his comments at me, his tone wistful.
"I don't know how many letters I wrote, but none of them got sent. Every time I tried to explain, it just came out sounding, you know, wrong or dumb. I finally let it be till I could work out what it was I wanted to say. I kept thinking I had time. I mean, he wasn't old by any stretch."
"It must have been his time. You can't argue with that," Peter said.
Winnie spoke up.
"If you don't feel like work today, you go ahead and take off. We can manage just fine."
"I'm all right," Guy responded, again with discomfort at being the center of attention.
We spent a few minutes going through an exchange of information, how I'd managed to locate Guy and what I knew of his family, which wasn't much. Peter was shaking his head, clearly regretful at the news I was bringing.
"We think of Guy as one of our own. First time I ever saw this boy. He's a sorry sight. His eyeballs were bright red, sort of rolling around in his head like hot marbles. Winnie and me, we'd been called to this church, and we'd driven all the way out to California from Fort Scott, Kansas. We'd heard all sorts of things about hippies and potheads and acid freaks, I think they called them. kids with their eyes burned out from staring at the sun, completely stoned. And there stood Guy by the side of the road with a sign that said, San Francisco. He was trying to be cool, but he just looked pitiful to me. Winnie didn't want me to stop. We had the two kids in the back seat, and she thought sure we'd be turned into homicide statistics.
It's been a lot of years since then, Winnie said. Pete looked over at Guy.
What are you thinking to do now, Guy? Go back to Santa Teresa? This might be time to sit down with your brothers and talk about the past. Maybe clean up some old business.
I don't know. I suppose. If they're willing to sit down with me, Guy said. I guess I'm not quite ready to make a decision about that.
He glanced at me.
I know they didn't send you up here begging me to come back, but it seems like I might have some say in the matter. Would it be all right if I called you in a day or two?
No problem. In the meantime, I need to head home, I said.
You've got my card. If I'm not in the office, try that second number, and the call will be forwarded automatically.
I took out a second business card and jotted down Tasha Howard's number. This is the attorney. I don't remember her phone number offhand. She has an office in Lompoc. You can call directory assistance and get the information from them. She's not that far away. If nothing else, you might make an appointment to have a chat with her. You'll need advice from an attorney of your own. I hope everything works out.
I do, too. I appreciate the fact you made the trip, Guy said. It's a lot more personal.
I shook hands with him, uttered polite noises in the direction of Peter and Winnie Antle, and made my getaway. I cruised down the main street of Marcella again, trying to get a feel for the place. Small and quiet. Unpretentious. I circled the block, driving along the few residential streets. The houses were small, built from identical plans, one-story stucco structures with flat roof lines. The exteriors were painted in pastel shades, pale Easter egg colors nestled in winter grass as dry as paper shreds. Most of the houses seemed shabby and dispirited. I saw only an occasional occupant. As I swung past the general store, heading out to the main road, I spotted a sign in the window advertising fresh sandwiches. On an impulse, I parked the car and went in and ordered a tuna salad on rye from the woman at the deli counter in the rear. We chatted idly while she busied herself with the sandwich preparations, wrapping my dill pickle in a square of waxed paper, so it wouldn't make the bread all mushy, she said. Behind me, two or three other customers went about their business, guiding small grocery carts up and down the aisles. No one turned to stare at me or paid me the slightest attention. I let her know I'd just been over at the church. She exhibited little curiosity about who I was or why I was visiting the pastor and his wife. Mention of Guy Malik produced no uneasy silences, nor any unsolicited confidences about his past history or his character. This seems like a nice town, I said, as she passed my lunch across the counter. I handed her a 10, which she rang into the cash register. If you like this kind of place, she remarked. Too quiet for my taste, but my husband was born here and insisted we come back. I like to kick up my heels, but about the best we can manage is a rummage sale now and then. Hoo-wee! She fanned herself comically, as if the excitement of used clothing was almost more than she could bear. You want a receipt? She said, counting out 7 ones and change. I'd appreciate it. She tore off the register receipt and handed it to me. You take care of yourself. Thanks. You too, I said. I ate while I drove, steering with one hand as I alternated bites of dill pickle and tuna sandwich. The price had included a bag of potato chips, and I munched on those too, figuring I'd cover all the necessary food groups. I'd forgotten to ask Guy his mother's maiden name, but the truth was I had no doubt he was who he said he was.
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.
I'd forgotten to ask Guy his mother's maiden name, but the truth was I had no doubt he was who he said he was. He reminded me of Jack, whose coloring and features were quite similar. Donovan and Bennett must have favored one parent, while Guy and Jack looked more like the other. As cynical as I was, I found myself taking at face value both the reformation of Guy Malik and his current association with Jubilee Evangelical. It was always possible, I supposed, that he and the minister were singularly crafty frauds who'd cooked up a cover story for any stranger who came calling. But for the life of me, I didn't see it, and I didn't believe anything sinister was afoot. If bucolic Marcella was the headquarters for some cult of neo-Nazis, Satanists, or motorcycle outlaws, it had sure escaped my notice. It was not until I had passed Santa Maria, heading south on 101, that I realized Guy Malik had never asked how much his share of the estate would be. I probably should have volunteered the information. I could have at least given him a ballpark figure. But the question had never come up, and I'd been too busy trying to evaluate his status for my report to Donovan. His emotional focus was on his father's death and the loss of his opportunity to make amends. Any profit was apparently beside the point as far as he was concerned. Oh, well. I figured Tasha would be in touch with him, and she could give him the particulars. I arrived in Santa Teresa without incident at 2 p.m. Since I was home earlier than I'd thought, I went into the office, typed up my notes, and stuck them in the file. I left two phone messages, one for Tasha at her office, and one on the Malik's home machine. I calculated my hours, the mileage and the miscellaneous expenses, and typed an invoice for my services, to which I affixed the receipt for the tuna sandwich. Tomorrow I'd include it with the typed report of my findings, send a copy to Tasha and one to Donovan. End of story, I thought. I retrieved my car, unticketed, from an illegal space and drove home, feeling generally satisfied with life. Dietz fixed supper that night, a skillet full of fried onions, fried potatoes, and fried sausages, with liberal doses of garlic and red pepper flakes, all served with a side of drab, grainy mustard that set your tongue aflame. Only two confirmed single people could eat a meal like that and imagine it was somehow nutritious. I handled the cleanup process, washing plates, flatware, and glasses, scrubbing out the frying pan while Dietz read the evening paper. Is this what couples did any given night of the week? In my twice-married life, it was the drama and grief I remembered most clearly, not the day-to-day stuff. This was entirely too domestic. Not unpleasant, but certainly unsettling to someone unaccustomed to company. At 8, we walked up to Rosie's and settled into a back booth together. Rosie's restaurant is poorly lighted, a tacky neighborhood establishment that's been there for 25 years, sandwiched between a laundromat and an appliance repair shop. The chrome and formica tables are of thrift shop vintage, and the booths lining the walls are made of construction-grade plywood, stained dark, complete with crude hand-gouged messages and splinters. It's an act of reckless abandon to slide across the seats, unless your tetanus shots are current. Over the years, the number of California smokers has steadily diminished, so the air quality has improved, while the clientele has not. Rosie's used to be a refuge for local drinkers who liked to start early in the day and stay until closing time. Now the tavern has become popular with assorted amateur sports teams who descend en masse after every big game, filling the air with loud talk, raucous laughter, and much stomping about. The regulars, all four bleary-eyed imbibers, have been driven to other places. I rather missed their slurred conversation, which was never intrusive. Rosie was apparently gone for the night, and the bartender was someone I'd never seen before. Dietz drank a couple of beers while I had a couple of glasses of Rosie's best screw-top Chardonnay, a puckering rendition of a California varietal she probably bought by the keg. I freely confess it was the alcohol that got me into trouble that night. I was feeling mellow and relaxed, somewhat less inhibited than usual, which is to say, ready to flap my mouth. Robert Dietz was beginning to look good to me, and I wasn't really sure how I felt about that. His face was chiseled in shadow, and his gaze crossed the room in restless assessment while we chatted about nothing in particular. Idly, I told him about William and Rosie's wedding and my adventures on the road, and he filled in details about his stay in Germany. Along with the attraction, I experienced a low-grade sorrow, so like a fever that I wondered if I were coming down with the flu. At one point, I shivered, and he looked over at me. "You okay?" he asked.
I stretched my hand out on the table, and he covered it with his, lacing his fingers through mine.
"What are we doing?" I asked.
"Good question. Why don't we talk about that? You go first."
I laughed, but the issue wasn't really funny, and we both knew it.
"Why'd you have to come back and stir things up? I was doing fine."
"What have I stirred up? We haven't done anything. We eat dinner, we have drinks. I sleep down, you sleep up. My knee's so bad you're in no danger of unwanted advances. I couldn't make it up those stairs if my life depended on it."
"Is that the good news or the bad?"
"I don't know. You tell me," he said.
"I don't want to get used to you."
"A lot of women can't get used to me. You're one of the few who seems remotely interested,"
he said, smiling slightly. "Here's a word to the wise. In the midst of a tender discussion with one woman, don't mention another one, especially in the plural. It's bad policy." The minute he said it, I had this sudden vision of a long line of females with me standing not even close to the front of the pack. I could feel my smile fade, and I retreated into silence like a turtle encountering a dog. His look became cautious.
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing. I'm fine. What makes you think there's anything wrong?"
"Let's don't talk at cross purposes," he said. "You obviously have something to say, so why don't you say it?"
"I don't want to."
"It doesn't matter."
"Kinsey."
"What?"
"Come on, just say it. There's no penalty for being honest."
"I don't know how to say it. You're here for 4 days, and what am I supposed to do with that? I'm not good at being left. It's the story of my life. Why get enmeshed when all it means is I get to have my heart ripped out?"
He lifted his eyebrows, shrugging with his face.
"I don't know what to tell you. I can't promise to stay. I've never stayed in one place for more than 6 months, max. Why can't we live in the present? Why does everything have to have a guarantee attached?"
"I'm not talking about guarantees."
"I think you are," he said. "You want to lean against the future, when the fact is, you don't know any more than I do about what's coming next."
"Well, that's true, and I'm not arguing that. All I'm saying is I don't want to get involved in an on-again, off-again relationship, which is what this is."
Dietz's expression was pained.
"I won't lie. I can't pretend I'll stay when I know I won't. What good would that do?"
I could feel my frustration rise.
"I don't want you to pretend, and I'm not asking you to promise. I'm just trying to be honest."
"About what?"
"About everything. People have rejected me all my life. Sometimes it's death or desertion, infidelity, betrayal, you name it. I've experienced every form of emotional treachery there is." "Well, big deal. Everybody suffered something in life, and so what? I'm not sitting around feeling sorry for myself. But I'd have to be a fool to lay myself open to that shit again."
"I understand that. I hear you, and believe me, I don't want to be the one to cause you pain. This is not about you. It's about me. I'm restless by nature. I hate to feel trapped. That's how I am. Pen me in and I'll tear the place apart trying to get out," he said. "My people were nomads. We were always on the move, always on the road. We lived out of suitcases. To me, being in one spot is oppressive." "You want to talk about death? It's the worst. When I was growing up, if we stayed in one town for long, my old man would get busted. He'd end up in county jail or in the hospital or the local drunk tank. Any school I attended, I was always the new kid, and I'd have to fight my way across the schoolyard just to stay alive. The happiest day of my life was the day we hit the road again."
"Free at last," I interjected.
"That's right. It's not that I might not want to stay. It's that I'm incapable of it."
"Oh, right. Incapable. Well, that explains it. You're excused," I said.
"Don't be so touchy. You know what I mean. God almighty, I'm not proud of myself. I don't relish the fact that I'm a rolling stone. I just don't want to kid myself, and I don't want to kid you."
"Thank you. That's great. In the meantime, I'm sure you have ways of amusing yourself."
He squinted.
"Where did that come from?"
"This is hopeless," I said.
I don't know why we even bother with this. You're addicted to wandering, and I'm rooted in place. You can't stay, and I can't leave because I love where I am. This is your biennial interlude, and I'm here for the duration, which means I'm probably doomed to a lifetime of guys like you.
Guys like me? That's nice. What does that mean?
Just what it says. Emotionally claustrophobic. You're a basket case. So long as I'm attracted to guys like you, I can bypass my own...
I stopped short, feeling like one of those cartoon dogs skidding on a cartoon floor.
Your own what?
None of your business, I said. Let's drop the conversation. I should have kept my mouth shut. I end up sounding like a whiner, which is not what I intend.
You're always so worried about sounding like a whiner, he said. Who cares if you whine? Be my guest.
Oh, now you say that.
Say what?
He said, exasperated. I assumed an attitude of patience that I scarcely felt. One of the first things you ever said to me was that you wanted... How did you phrase it? Obedience without whining. You said very few women ever mastered that.
I said that?
Yes, you did. I've tried very hard ever since not to whine in your presence.
Don't be ridiculous. I didn't mean it that way, he said. I don't even remember saying it, but I was probably talking about something else. Anyway, don't change the subject. I don't want to leave it on this note. As long as the issue's on the table, let's get it settled.
What's to settle? We can't settle anything. There's no way to resolve it, so let's drop the whole business. I'm sorry I brought it up. I've already got this ongoing family nonsense. Maybe I'm upset about that.
What nonsense? You're related to these people, so what's the problem?
I don't want to get into it. Aside from whining, I hate to feel like I'm repeating myself.
How can you repeat yourself when you never told me to begin with?
I ran a hand through my hair and stared down at the tabletop. I'd been hoping to avoid the subject, but the topic did seem safer than discussing our relationship, whatever that consisted of. I couldn't come up with any rational defense of my reluctance to engage with this newfound family of mine. I just didn't want to do it. Finally, I said, I guess I don't like to be pressured. They're so busy trying to make up for lost time. Why can't they just mind their own business? I'm not comfortable with all this buddy-buddy stuff. You know how stubborn I get when I'm pushed.
Why did you agree to work for that attorney, then? Isn't she your cousin?
Well, yes, but I didn't intend to agree. I intended to turn her down, but then greed and curiosity got the better of me. I have a living to earn, and I didn't want to refuse out of perversity. I know I'll regret it, but I'm into it now, so there's no sense beating myself up.
Sounds harmless enough on the face of it.
It's not harmless. It's annoying. And besides, that isn't the point. The point is, I'd like for them to respect my boundaries.
What boundaries? She hired you to do a job. As long as you get paid, that's the end of it.
Let's hope. Besides, it's not her so much as the other two. Liza and Pam. If I give an inch, they'll invade my space.
Oh, bullshit. That's California psychobabble. You can't live your life like a radio talk show.
What do you know? I don't notice you all cozied up to your family.
I could see him flinch. His expression shifted abruptly to one of injury and irritation.
Low blow. What I say about my kids, I don't want you throwing back in my face.
You're right. I'm sorry. I withdraw the remark.
Withdraw the knife and the wound's still there, he snapped. What's the matter with you? You're so bristly these days. You're doing everything you can to keep me at arm's length.
I am not, I said, and then I stared at him, squinting. Is that true?
Well, look at your behavior. I haven't even been here 2 days and we're already fighting. What's that about? I didn't travel all this way to pick a fight with you. I wanted to see you. I was excited we'd have time together. Hell, if I'd wanted to fight, I could have stayed with Naomi.
Why didn't you? I don't mean the question in a mean-hearted way, but I'm curious. What happened?
Oh, who knows? I have my version, she has hers. Sometimes I think relationships have a natural lifespan. Ours ran out. That's all it was. The explanations come afterwards when you try to make sense of it. Let's get back to you. What's going on in your head?
I'd rather fight than feel nothing.
Those are your only two options?
That's what it feels like, but I couldn't say for sure. He reached out and gave my hair a tug.
What am I going to do with you?
What am I going to do with you? I replied.
Chapter 7. When we returned to the apartment at 10:15, Henry's kitchen light was on. Deet said his knee was killing him, so he let himself into the apartment, where he intended to take a couple of pain pills, prop his feet up, and put his ice pack to work. I said I'd be along momentarily. Our conversation at Rosie's hadn't really gone anywhere. I couldn't bear to continue, and I couldn't bear behaving as though the subject hadn't been broached. I didn't know what I wanted from him, and I wasn't sure how to say it anyway, so I just ended up sounding needy. My general policy is this: if your mind isn't open, keep your mouth shut, too. I knocked on Henry's back door, waving at him through the window when he looked up at me. He was sitting in his rocking chair with the evening paper and his glass of Jack Daniels. He smiled and waved back, setting the paper aside so he could let me in. He had the heat turned up, and the inside air was not only warm, but deliciously scented with yesterday's cinnamon rolls. "This feels great. It's really cold out there," I said. The kitchen table was covered with old black-and-white photographs, sorted into piles. I glanced at them briefly as I pulled out a kitchen chair and turned my attention to him. From my point of view, Henry Pitts is perfection. Smart, good-natured, and responsible, with the cutest legs I've ever seen. He's been my landlord for 5 years, since the day I spotted the ad for the apartment in a laundromat. Henry was looking for a long-term tenant who was clean and quiet, no children, loud parties, or small yapping dogs. As a lifelong mobile home inhabitant, I was addicted to compact spaces, but ready to limit contact with a lot of close, unruly neighbors. Trailer park life, for all its virtues, entails an intimate acquaintance with other people's private business. Since I make a living as a snoop, I'd just as soon keep my personal affairs to myself. The converted single-car garage Henry was offering was better than my fantasies, and affordable as well. Since then, the place had been bombed and rebuilt, the interior fitted out in teak, and as cleverly designed as a ship's. From the outset, Henry and I established just enough of a relationship to suit us both. Over the years, he's managed to civilize me to some extent, and I'm certainly more agreeable now than I was back then. Little by little, we forged the bond between us. Until now, I consider him the exemplary mix of friend and generic family member.
"You want a cup of tea?" he asked.
"No, thanks. I just stopped to say hi before I hit the sack. Are those family pictures?" I asked, picking one at random.
"That's the claim," he said. "Nell sent me those. She came across two boxes of old family photographs, but none are labeled. No names, no dates. She hasn't any idea who these people are, and neither do the other Sibs. What a mess. Take my word for it, you should mark all your photographs, even if it's just a quick note on the back. You might know who's who, but nobody else will."
"Do they look familiar to you?"
"A few."
He took the print I was looking at and squinted as he held it to the light. I peered over his shoulder. The woman in the picture must have been in her 20s, with a broad, bland face and hair drawn back in a bun. She wore a white midi blouse with a calf-length skirt, dark stockings, and flat dark shoes with a bow across the instep. Standing beside her was a glum-faced girl of 8, with a drop-waist sailor dress and ankle-high lace-up shoes.
"I believe this is a picture of my mother's younger sister, Augusta, taken in Topeka, Kansas, back in 1915. The child's name was Rebecca Rose, if memory serves. She and her mother both died in the big influenza epidemic of 1918.
He picked up another one.
"This is my mother with my grandfather Tillman. I'm surprised Nell didn't recognize them, except her eyesight's fading. Now that I think of it, I'm not sure why it matters. None of us have children, so once we're gone, it won't make any difference who these people are."
"Well, that seems sad. Why don't you put them in an album and pass them on to me?
I'll pretend they're mine.
What was his first name?
Klaus. My mother's name was Gudrun.
The man staring fixedly at the camera must have been in his late 70s, the daughter beside him in her 50s by the look of her. I said,
"What's the name Tillman? Is that German? I somehow imagined you were all Swedes or Finns."
"Oh, no, we're not Scandinavian. They're gloomy sorts, in my opinion. The Tillmans were good German stock, headstrong, autocratic, vigorous, and exacting. Some would say impossible, but that's a matter of interpretation. Longevity is genetic, and don't ever let anybody tell you otherwise. I read those articles about folks who live to be 100. They all try to take credit, claim it's because they smoke or don't smoke, eat yogurt, take vitamins, or a tablespoon of vinegar a day. What nonsense. War and accidents excepted, you live a long time because you come from other people who live a long time. You have to take responsibility. You can't subject yourself to any kind of gross mistreatment. My mother lived to be 103, and I imagine the remaining 5 of us will live that long as well.
You certainly seem to be in good shape. Nell's what, 96? And you have your 86th birthday coming up on Valentine's Day.
Henry nodded, making a motion as if to knock on wood.
We're healthy in the main, though we're all shrinking down to some extent. We've talked about this, and it's our contention that the shrinkage is nature's way of assuring you don't take up so much space in your coffin. You lighten up, too. Feels like taking air into your bones. Makes it easy on the pallbearers. And, of course, your faculties shut down. You get blind as a bat and your hearing fades. Charlie says it sounds like he's got a pillow on his head all the time these days. Get old, you might as well not worry about your dignity. Anybody talks about dignity for old folks has never been around one, as far as I can tell. You can keep your spunk, but you have to give up your vanity early on. We're all in diapers. Well, I'm not, but then I'm the baby in the family. The rest of them leak any time they cough or laugh too hard. Nell says one reason she misses William so much now he's moved out here is because they can't play bridge like they used to. Have to play three-handed, which isn't as much fun. Lewis was thinking about asking a cousin to move in, but Nell won't tolerate another woman in the house. She says she's had her brothers to herself now for 60 years, and she's not about to change. Nell says once she goes, they can do anything they want, depending on who's left.
I can't believe they're still willing to endure the winters in Michigan. Why don't they all move out here? You could play all the bridge you want.
There's talk of that. We'll just have to see. Nell has her ladies' luncheon group, and she hates to leave them.
Henry put the photo down and took his seat again.
Now then, how are you? I had a nice chat with your friend Dietz. He says you picked up some work.
Actually, I finished it. One of those quickies you remember fondly when the tough ones come along, I said.
I took a few minutes to fill him in on the search for Guy Malik.
Henry shook his head.
What's going to happen? Do you think he'll get his share of the estate?
Who knows? I don't always hear the end of it, but Tasha thinks they'll be able to work something out.
How long will Dietz be here? I thought I'd have the two of you over for supper one night.
Probably not long. He's on his way up to Santa Cruz to see his sons, I said.
Well, let me know if he's still going to be here Saturday, and I'll cook something special. We'll invite William and Rosie and Mosa Lowenstein if she's free.
By the time I let myself into my place, Dietz had fallen asleep in his underwear, slouched down in his chair, snoring slightly. The television set was on, the volume low, the channel tuned to a nature show about underwater shark attacks. Dietz had his leg propped up on the edge of the sofa bed, a blanket pulled across his chest and shoulders. The partially melted ice pack had toppled to the floor. I put that ice pack in the freezer and took out a second one, laying it carefully across his knee without waking him. His kneecap was swollen, the bare flesh looking pale and vulnerable. I left him as he was, knowing he'd wake long before morning. He sleeps in fits and starts like an animal in the wild, and I knew from past experience he seldom manages to make it through the night without getting up at least twice. I eased off my shoes and made my way up the spiral stairs. From above I stared down at him. His lined face looked alien in sleep, as if sculptured in clay. I seldom saw him at ease. He was restless by nature, perpetually in motion, his features animated by the sheer force of his nervous energy. Even as I watched, he stirred himself awake, jerking upright with a look of disorientation. I could see him wince, reaching for the ice pack balanced on his distended joint. I stepped away from the loft rail and went into the bathroom, where I washed my face and brushed my teeth. It was no doubt the proximity to all that testosterone, but I could feel the murmur of sexuality at the base of my spine. I grabbed an oversized T-shirt from a hook on the bathroom door. I usually sleep in the nude, but it seemed like a bad idea. Once ready for bed, I turned out the light and slipped under the quilt. I reached out and set my alarm, watching the digital clock flip from 11:04 to 11:05. Below, I could hear Dietz get up and move into the kitchen. The refrigerator door opened and closed. He took down a glass and poured himself a drink. Wine, orange juice, or milk? Something liquid at any rate. I heard him pull out a kitchen stool, followed by the rustle of newspaper. I wondered what he was thinking. Wondered what would happen if I heard him climbing the stairs. Maybe I should have pulled on a robe and gone down to join him, thrown caution to the wind and to hell with the consequences. But it was not in my nature. Being single for so long had made me cautious about men. I stared up at the plexiglass skylight above my bed, thinking about the risks involved in reaching out to him. Passion never lasts, but then what does? If you could have it all, but only briefly, would the rush of love be worth the price in pain? I could feel myself sinking into sleep as though weighted down with stones. I didn't rise again until 5:59 a.m. I pulled on my sweats, preparing for my run as usual. Dietz was in the shower when I left the house, but I noticed with a pang he was in the process of packing. He'd laid the soft-sided suitcase open on the floor near the sofa bed, which he'd folded away. The blanket had been refolded and placed across one end. He'd piled the sheets he'd used near the washer. Maybe he felt his exodus would address my issues with him, minimizing the chances of my forming an attachment. What I noticed, perversely, was that, having felt nothing on his arrival, I was now afflicted with a stinging sense of loss at his departure. He'd been with me for 2 days, and I was already suffering, so maybe I'd been smart not to take things any further. I'd been celibate for so long, what was another year without sex? I made an involuntary sound that might have been a whimper if I allowed myself such things. I closed the door quietly behind me, breathing deeply as though the damp morning air might ease the fire in my chest. Having passed through the front gate, I paused while I stretched, keeping my mind a blank. In the last several years as a private investigator, I've developed a neat trick for shutting off my feelings. Like others who work in the helping professions, doctors and nurses, police officers, social workers, paramedics, emotional disconnection is sometimes the only way to function in the face of death with all its tacky variations. Originally, my detachment took several minutes of concentrated effort, but now I make the shift in the blink of an eye. Mental health enthusiasts are quick to assure us that our psychological well-being is best served by staying in touch with our feelings. But surely they're not referring to the icky, unpleasant ones. The run itself was unsatisfactory. The dawn was overcast, the sky a brooding gray, unrelieved by any visible sunrise. Gradually, daylight overtook the lowering dark, but the whole of it had the bleached look of an old black-and-white photograph. My gait felt choppy, and I never really hit my stride. The air was so chilly I couldn't even generate a decent sweat. I dutifully counted off the miles, feeling gratified to be doing it in spite of myself. Some days the discipline is an end in itself, a way of asserting the will in the face of life's little setbacks. I walked the half-block home, carefully brushing aside any slovenly sentiment. Dietz was sitting at the counter when I got in. He'd put on a pot of coffee and set out my cereal bowl. His bowl was already washed, rinsed, and drying in the dish rack. His suitcase, fully zipped, was waiting by the door along with his garment bag. Through the open bathroom door, I could see he'd tidied the basin of all his personal possessions. The scent of soap mingled with his aftershave, a damp male perfume permeating everything.
"I thought it might be easier if I took off," he said.
"Sure, no problem. I hope you're not doing it on my account."
No, no. You know me. I'm not that good at staying put, he said. Anyway, you probably have a lot of work to do.
Oh, tons, I said. You're heading up to Santa Cruz?
Eventually, yes. I'll drive on up the coast, maybe spend a day in Cambria. With this knee, I have to break up the trip anyway. You know, get out and stretch every hour or so. Keep it warm and loose. Otherwise, it locks up.
What time are you taking off?
Whenever you leave for work.
Well, great. I'll just grab a shower then, and you can hit the road.
Take your time. I'm in no hurry, he said.
I can see that, I remarked as I headed up to the loft. This time he didn't ask if I was mad. This was good, because in truth I was furious. Under the fury was the old familiar pain. Why does everyone end up leaving me? What did I ever do to them? I went through my morning routine as efficiently as possible, flung on my clothes, and ate my cereal without pausing to read the paper. To demonstrate my indifference to his abrupt departure, I took out fresh sheets and asked him to help me remake the sofa bed. I hoped the implication was that some other guy was lined up for bed space as soon as he left. Neither of us said much, and what we said was transactional.
Where's the other pillowcase?
About like that. Once the sofa was redone, he took his suitcase to the car and came back for the garment bag. I walked him out to the curb and we exchanged one of those insincere kisses with the sound effects attached. Mch. He fired up his Porsche and I dutifully waved as he roared off down the street. You little shit, I thought. I went into the office, ignoring a faint tendency to tear up for no reason. The day yawned in front of me like a sinkhole in the street. This was just what it felt like when he left before. Now, how does this happen to someone of my rare spunk and independence? I played a few rounds of solitaire, paid some bills, and balanced my checkbook. Anxiety whispered in my gut like a stomachache. When the phone finally rang just before lunch, I snatched up the receiver, absurdly grateful at the interruption.
Kinsey, this is Donovan. How are you?
Gee, I'm just fine. How are you?
Well enough. Listen, we got your message, and we'd like to compliment you on a job well done. Tasha had to fly back to San Francisco this morning, but she said she didn't think you'd mind giving us the information firsthand. Could you stop by the house for a drink late this afternoon?
Well, sure, I could do that. I was going to type up my report and put it in the mail, but I can give you a rundown in person if you'd prefer.
I'd appreciate that. I expect Jack and Bennett will want to be there as well. That way, if they have questions, you can fill us all in at the same time, and save yourself the repetition. Would 5:30 be convenient?
Fine with me, I said.
Good. We'll look forward to seeing you.
After I hung up, I could feel myself shrug. I had nothing against an informal report, as long as I didn't somehow get sucked into the family drama. Aside from Guy, I wasn't crazy about the Malik brothers. I happened to believe Guy had changed his wicked ways, so maybe I could do him a service and convince the others. Not that it was any of my business how the monies were distributed, but if there were any lingering questions about his worthiness, I certainly had an opinion. Besides, with Dietz now gone, I didn't have anything better to do. I skipped lunch and spent the afternoon cleaning my office. Lonnie Kingman had a maintenance crew that serviced the premises weekly on Friday afternoons, but it felt therapeutic to get in there and scrub. I even spent 20 minutes dusting the artificial ficus plant someone had once mistaken for real. The space I occupied had originally been a conference room with a full executive bathroom attached. I found a plastic bucket, sponges, cleansers, a toilet brush, and mop, and entertained myself mightily killing imaginary germs. My method of coping with depression is to take on chores so obnoxious and disgusting that reality seems pleasant by comparison. By 3 o'clock, I smelled of sweat and household bleach, and I'd forgotten what I was so unhappy about. Well, actually, I remembered, but I didn't give a shit. Having sanitized the suite, I locked the door, stripped off my clothes, hopped in the executive shower, and scrubbed myself. I dressed again in the same jeans, pulling on a fresh turtleneck from the ready supply I keep handy for sudden travel. What's life without a toothbrush and clean underpants?
I typed up the official version of my encounter with Guy Malik, tucking one copy in my office files, another in my handbag. The third I addressed to Tasha Howard at her San Francisco office. The end. Finito. Done, done, done. This was the last job I'd ever take from her. By 5:25, dressed in my best and only wool tweed blazer, I drove through the entrance to the Malik estate. It was close to dark by then, the winter-shortened days still characterized by early twilights. My headlights swept in a forlorn arc across the stucco wall surrounding the 15-acre property. Along the rim of the wall, three strands of rusted barbed wire had been strung years ago, broken now in places and looking singularly ineffective. Who knows what intruders were anticipated back then? A chilly wind had picked up, and the darkened treetops swayed and shivered, whispering together about things unseen. There were lights on in the house, two upstairs windows illuminated in pale yellow, where much of the first floor was dark. The housekeeper had neglected to turn on the outside lights. I parked in the turnaround and picked my way across the cobblestone courtyard to the shadowy portico that sheltered the entranceway in front. I rang the bell and waited, crossing my arms for warmth. The porch light was finally flipped on, and Myrna opened the door a crack. "Hi, Myrna. Kinsey Milhone. I was here the other day. Donovan invited me for drinks." Myrna didn't exactly break into song at the news. Apparently, advanced classes in housekeeper's training school cautioned the students not to give expression to sudden bursts of joy. In the 2 days since I'd seen her last, she'd renewed the dye job in her hair, and the whole of it was now a white blonde that looked like it would be cold to the touch. Her uniform consisted of a gray top worn over matching gray pants. I would have bet money the waistband was unbuttoned underneath the tunic. "This way," she said. Her crepe-soled shoes squeaked slightly on the polished parquet floor. A woman called down from somewhere above our heads. "Myrna, was that the front door? We're expecting someone for drinks." I glanced up, following the sound of her voice. A brunette in her late 30s was leaning on the stair rail above our heads. She caught sight of me and brightened. "Oh, hi. You must be Kinsey. You want to come on up?" Myrna veered off without another word, disappearing into the rear of the house as I climbed the stairs. Christy held out her hand when I reached the upper landing. "I'm Christy Malik. Nice to meet you," she said as we shook hands. "I take it you've met Myrna." "More or less," I said. I took her in at a glance, like an instant Polaroid. She was a fine-featured brunette with shiny dark hair, worn shoulder length. She was very slender, wearing jeans and a bulky black-ribbed sweater that came down almost to her knees. She had the sleeves rolled back and her wrists were thin, her fingers long and cool. Her eyes were small, a dark, penetrating blue beneath a lightly feathered brow. Her teeth were as perfect as a mouthwash adds. The absence of eye makeup gave her a recessive, slightly anxious air, though her manner was friendly and her smile was warm enough. "Donovan called to say he'd be a few minutes late. Jack's on his way home and Bennett's around someplace. I'm just going through Bader's papers and I'd love some company." Still talking to me, she turned and moved toward the master bedroom, which I could see through an open doorway. "We're still looking for the missing will, among other things. Ever hopeful," she added wryly. "I thought Bennett was going to do that." "This is how Bennett does things. He loves to delegate." I hoped there was a touch of irony in her tone. I couldn't be sure, so I kept my mouth shut. The suite we entered was enormous, two substantial rooms separated by a pair of doors that had been pushed into their respective wall pockets. We passed through the outer room, which had been furnished as a bedroom. The walls were padded fabric, covered in rose-colored silk, with a watered sheen to the finish. The carpet was off-white, a dense, cut pile. Pale, heavy drapes had been pulled back to reveal the leaded glass windows that looked out onto the cobblestone entrance at the front of the house. There was a marble fireplace on the wall to the left. Two matching sofas were arranged on either side of it, plump, upholstered pieces covered in a subdued floral chintz. The four-poster bed had been flawlessly made, not a ripple or a wrinkle in the snowy white silk coverlet. The surface of the bed table seemed unnaturally bare, as if once personal items had now been hidden from sight. It might have been my imagination, but the room seemed to harbor the lingering scent of sickness. I could see that closets were being emptied, the contents, suits and dress shirts, packed into large cardboard boxes supplied by the local thrift store industries downtown. "This is gorgeous," I said.
"Isn't it?"
Beyond the sliding doors, a home office had been set up with a large walnut desk and antique wooden file cabinets. The ceilings in both rooms were 12 feet high, but this was by far the cozier of the two. A fire had been laid in a second marble fireplace, and Christy paused to add a log to an already snapping blaze. The walls here were paneled in walnut as dark and glossy as fudge. I could see a copier, a fax machine, computer, and a printer arranged on the built-in shelves on either side of the fireplace. A paper shredder stood on one side of the desk, its green on button lighted. I could see printed acknowledgments stacked up, waiting to be addressed to those who'd sent flowers to the funeral. Christy returned to the desk, where she'd emptied the contents of two drawers into banker's boxes that she'd labeled with a black marker. There were two big plastic garbage bags bulging with discarded papers. Thick files were stacked on the desktop, and a number of empty file folders were strewn across the carpet. This was the kind of task I knew well, classifying the odds and ends left behind by the dead. Below, in the courtyard, we could hear a motorcycle cruise in, the engine being revved once more before it was silenced. Christy cocked her head.
"I hear the Harley. Sounds like Jack's home."
"How's it going so far?" Her expression was a wry mix of skepticism and despair.
"Bader was supremely organized for the most part, but he must have lost his enthusiasm for jobs like this. Look at all this stuff. I swear if I'm ever diagnosed as terminal, I'm going to clean out my files before I get too sick to care. What if you kept pornographic pictures or something like that? I'd hate to think of someone sorting through my private affairs."
"Nothing in my life is that interesting," I said. "You want help?"
"Not really, but I could use the moral support," she said. "I've been in here for hours. I have to look at every single piece of paper and figure out if it's worth saving, though most aren't, as far as I can tell. I mean, what do I know? Anything I'm not sure about, I put in one pile. The really junky stuff I go ahead and shove in a garbage bag. I don't dare shred a thing, and I'm afraid to toss much."
"I know, Bennett. As sure as I pitch something, he tears in here and wants to know where it is. He's done that to me twice, and it was just dumb luck the trash hadn't been picked up. I'm out there in the dark, like a bag lady, pulling crumpled papers out of the garbage bag. This third pile is everything that looks important. For instance, here's something you might like." She picked up a file from the stack on top of the desk and handed it to me. "Bader must have put this together back in the early 60s. A quick glance inside revealed a collection of newspaper clippings related to guys' past misbehavior. I read one at random, an article dating back to 1956, detailing the arrest of two juveniles, boys ages 14 and 13, who were believed to be responsible for a spree of graffiti vandalism. One of the teens was booked into juvenile hall, the other released to his parents. There must have been 25 such snippets. In some cases, the authorities withheld the names because the boy or boys arrested were still minors. In other articles, Guy Malik was identified by name.
I wonder why Bader kept clippings. It seems odd, I said. Maybe to remind himself why he disinherited the kid. I figure Bennett will want him for ammunition if it comes down to that. It's exhausting just trying to make these decisions.
Quite a job, I said, and then shifted the subject matter. You know, it occurred to me that since the two wills were drawn up only 3 years apart, the two witnesses for the first might have been witnesses for the second will, too, especially if they were paralegals or law clerks working in the attorney's office.
She looked at me with interest.
Good point. You'll have to mention that to Donovan. None of us are anxious to see $5 million flying out the window. There was a tap at the door, and we both turned to see that Myrna had reappeared.
Donovan's home. He asked me to serve the hors d'oeuvres in the living room.
Tell him we'll be down in a second, as soon as I wash my hands. Oh, and see if you can round up the other two. Myrna took in the request, murmured something inaudible, and withdrew from the room. Christy shook her head, lowering her voice a notch. She may be on the glum side, but she's the only person in the house who doesn't argue with everyone. Chapter 8. Lights were on, and Donovan was in the living room when Christy and I came downstairs. He changed out of his work clothes, pulling on a heavy cream-colored knit sweater over casual pants. He'd exchanged his dress shoes for a pair of sheepskin slippers that made his feet look huge. A fire had been laid, and he was poking at the logs, turning a bulky wedge of oak so that its uppermost side would catch. Donovan picked up another piece of wood and thunked it on top. A shower of sparks flew up the chimney. He replaced the fire screen and wiped his hands on his handkerchief, glancing over at me.
"I see you've met Christy. We appreciate your coming over. Keeps it simpler all around. Can I make you a drink? We've got just about anything you'd want."
"A glass of Chardonnay would be fine."
"I'll get it," Christy said promptly. She moved over to a sideboard crowded with liquor bottles.
A bottle of Chardonnay had been chilling in a cooler beside a clear lucite ice bucket and an assortment of glasses. She began to peel the foil from the neck of the wine bottle with a look at Donovan.
"You having wine?" "Probably with dinner. I think I'll have a martini first." "Gin is Bennett's winter drink,"
he added as an aside to me. "Ah, the seasonal alcoholic. What a nice idea. Gin in the winter, maybe vodka in spring. Summer would be tequila, and he could round out the autumn with a little bourbon or scotch." While she opened the wine, I took a momentary survey. Like the bedroom above, this room was immense. The 12-foot ceiling was rimmed with 10-inch crown molding, the walls papered in a narrow blue and cream stripe that had faded with the years. The pale oriental carpet had to be 17 feet wide and probably 25 feet long. The furniture had been arranged in two groupings. At the far end of the room, four wing chairs faced one another near the front windows. Closer to the center of the room, three large sofas formed a U in front of the fireplace. All of the side pieces, an armoire, an escritoire, and two carved and inlaid wooden tables, were the sort I'd seen in antique stores. Heavy, faintly fussy, with price tags that made you squint because you thought you'd read them wrong. Christy returned with two glasses of wine and handed one to me. She took a seat on one of the sofas, and I sat down across from her with a murmured, "Thanks." The blue floral pattern was faded to a soft white, the fabric threadbare along the arms and the cushion fronts. There was a large brass bowl with fresh flowers and several copies of Architectural Digest lined up on the square glass coffee table in the crook of the U. There was also an untidy stack of what looked like condolence cards. While I was thinking about it, I took out my typed report and placed it on the table in front of me. I'd leave it for Donovan so he'd have a copy for his files. I heard footsteps in the hall and the sound of voices. Jack and Bennett came into the living room together. Whatever they'd been discussing, their expressions were now neutral, conveying nothing but benign interest at the sight of me. Bennett wore a running suit of some silky material that rustled when he walked. Jack looked as if he'd just come in off the golf course, his hair still disheveled from the imprint of his visor. He wore a bright orange sweater vest over a pink short-sleeved golf shirt, and his gait tended to a lilt as if he were still wearing cleats. Jack poured himself a scotch and water as dark as iced tea, while Bennett made a pitcher of martinis that he stirred with a long glass wand. I made note of his vermouth-to-gin ratio, roughly 2 parts per million. He poured one for himself and one for Donovan, adding olives to both. He brought the martini pitcher over to the coffee table and set it down within range. While drinks were being poured, various pleasantries were exchanged, none of them heartfelt. As with tobacco, the rituals of alcohol seemed to be a stalling technique until those assembled could get themselves psychologically situated. I had an odd sensation in my chest, the same itch of anxiety I'd felt before a third-grade dance recital in which I played a bunny. Not a specialty of mine. My Aunt Jin was ill and unable to attend, so I'd been forced to do my hippie-hopping in front of countless alien adults who didn't seem to find me winsome.
My legs were too skinny, and my fake ears wouldn't stand up. The brothers Malik watched me with about the same enthusiasm. Donovan took a seat next to Christy on the couch across from me, while Jack sat facing the fireplace with Bennett on his left. It was interesting to see the three brothers in the same room together. Despite the similarities in their coloring, their faces were very different, Bennett's the more so because of his beard and mustache. Donovan and Jack were built along finer lines, though neither was as appealing as their errant brother Guy. Jack leaned forward and began to sift idly through the sympathy cards.